Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I am Gary Gramling, here with Andy Benoit. And Andy, we've been gone for a while. Were you worried that we weren't coming back?
You always worry about that, but I'm back in football mode now, or I'm getting right where I need to be with football mode. I spent the day reading film notes about the Packers offense, so I'm going to come into this one a little bit cranky, I think.
There you go. Andy and I have been exchanging letters, keeping up on each other's lives while we've been off, but we're back, and we're going to continue the off-season position rankings. Today, it's going to be linebackers. We've done a bunch of good ones in the past. You can go back, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, find them all. Today's going to be linebackers. We are counting down the top 15 linebackers in football. Now, just a clarification, these do not include edge rushers. So a guy like Von Miller, not going to be in this one, plays with his hand down on passing downs. Bruce Irvin is another guy we had talked about. I don't know if he'll make the edge rusher rankings, but he was not considered for this group of linebackers. These are off the line of scrimmage stack linebackers here. As always, AP poll style, myself, Andy, and Jeff Irwin ranked our top 15. If you got a first place vote, 15 points. Last place vote, 1 point. And Andy's vote counts as double because he is just that smart. Andy, we're going to jump right into this thing. Starting with others receiving votes, we had CJ Mosley, Vontaze Burfict, Dante Hightower, Lawrence Timmons, Wesley Woodyard, Paul Posluszny. And this actually started at 17 because we had a tie for 15. Now, among those names I just ran through, anyone you are upset about?
Well, I had a few of those guys on my list. I had Posluszny 15. I had Timmons at 13. Did you say CJ Mosley was on at the front of that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had him 14. So I wouldn't say, and I had Burfict 16, and he probably deserves to be 10, but he is such a double-edged sword because mm-hmm. he's a maniac that you don't, I gave him demerits for that, which usually you don't get that in football. But yeah. I think in his case, he takes as much off the table as he puts on the table. So, and I had Hightower at 18. So no, I think I'm pretty good with this. When do I get to rip Jeff Irwin's list? I want to know that.
Soon enough. Soon enough, friend.
Can we just tell, you don't want me to do this, but we're not going to say who it was, but there were two linebackers on Irwin's list that were such embarrassing inclusions that we're not even mentioning them in the others receiving votes. We're going to pretend like they weren't voted on.
We have erased them from
the
record.
Is that fair?
Strike them from the record. Andy made that objection. I said sustained, and we struck them from the record here. Lawyer talk.
They're still counting. Like, it's not going to change our polls. We're just not
yes.
going to even bother analyzing them.
Yeah.
And he's got some other guys up at the top of his list that are good players that we're going to have to rip into them because he's ranking them like they are Hall of Famers.
Hall of Famers might be a bit much. I mean, we had a unanimous one this week. That guy's probably going to go Hall of Fame.
Come on. You cannot exaggerate on this kind of thing, Gary.
Well, we're coming out firing here, coming off our vacation. Let's jump into the top 15. Again, like I said, we actually had a bunch of ties this week, which is kind of weird. So we'll start with a tie for 15th. We had DeAndre Levy and Jarrell Freeman, a couple of NFC North guys. Levy was really – I ended up taking Levy off, actually, because he just hasn't been on the field enough the last 2 years. And it's to the point where I'm not sure what he's going to be when he comes back. But – he's awesome. When he was healthy, he was tremendous, and I think he would have been top five for me if we were doing this list 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. I thought 2 years ago that was when he was one of the three best linebackers in the NFL, and he deserved to be first-team All-Pro, and I don't think he even made the Pro Bowl. No. That was when Detroit had the best run defense in the league.
Yes.
It was Ndamukong Suh's last year there. And they had the best, maybe first or second best statistical run defense. And a big reason why was Levy could play the run out of nickels so well.
Yeah.
That's key anymore. You're going to hear the word nickel a lot in this discussion, just like you have with all our other positions, because teams are going three wide, as you know. And when you go three wide receivers, that changes the run game. And it makes it more about space and angles to the ball in space. And Levy is as good as anybody in the NFL in that department. Freeman's also very good at it. The difference between the two in my mind, and I think it's a big one, I would not rank Freeman top 15. I have Levy top 7 or 8, I think.
Yeah.
The difference is a consistency factor. Freeman will have some gap control issues at times. I don't know if he's a guesser or what leads to that, but he is a little more up and down than Levy is.
Yeah. You know, Levy, I still remember Levy in 2014 when they knocked off the Packers at Ford Field. I mean, he was all over the place. He dominated that game. They had him covering Jordy Nelson a little bit that day. And not that he completely shut down Jordy Nelson, but he held his own, and that gives pretty phenomenal flexibility. As far as Freeman goes, I had him at the back end of my top 15, I think. I had him... Yeah, I had him 15th. He was... I still remember... So when he was in the CFL, they played him all over the place. He played a little bit of, you know, what would have been a traditional cornerback type of position when he was out there, because they do all sorts of wacky things out in the CFL. But, yeah, he's a shaky, I would say, in Indianapolis. But, you know, when he flashes, he's very good. And that's going to be an interesting pairing they have there in Chicago. And the guy he's going to be paired with comes in this tie for 13. That is Danny Trevathan going to Chicago, and he is tied with Ryan Shazier for 13th place in our poll. What are your thoughts on either of those guys, Andy?
Well, Trevathan, I understand why he got paid for the Bears, and I think that's a good decision. Chicago badly needed help at inside linebacker. They had the worst inside linebacker situation in the NFL last year, and that's a big deal in Vic Fangio's scheme. If you recall, when Fangio, their defensive coordinator there under John Fox in Chicago, when he was at his best, it was when he had Patrick Willis and Navarro Bowman in San Francisco. Now, a lot of coordinators will be at their best with guys like that, but Fangio did a very good job of capitalizing on those guys' skill set. And that skill set was they could play man-to-man coverage against running backs and tight ends. One would take the back, the other would take the tight end. I believe Willis was the guy that had the tight end, and Bowman had the back, if I remember. And they've got that option to do that in Chicago now. Trevathan can handle backs or tight ends, and Freeman can, I think, skill set wise. Now, I don't know if they have the, let's say, actually attribute wise, I don't know if they have the skills of covering, but they certainly have the physical tools to do it. And when you do that, you become a lot more flexible with how you can deploy your safeties. Because if the linebacker is taking care of the running back and the tight end, that opens up both safeties to be used however you want to use them. Blitzers, help coverage over the top, which is what Fangio likes to do, however you want. So Trevathan could be very valuable in that sense. I don't think he, now, as an athlete, though, I don't think he's anywhere near Shazier's level. I don't think more than, there might not be another guy other than Jamie Collins in the NFL who can offer the physical dominance that Shazier can. And I think what we saw with him late last season in that Bengals playoff game, and even the weeks before, where he is so much faster than everybody. Didn't he beat Antonio Brown in a foot race a few weeks ago?
I didn't see that. Did that happen?
I believe, I forget who posted it, but Shazier won the foot race, which doesn't, look, that doesn't mean he can just run all over the field, except he does run all over the field. He has, I guess he's got straight line speed, which is what the foot race thing means. But he knows how to use it from a football standpoint as well. And in Pittsburgh's scheme, the better the inside linebackers are, the more diverse the scheme can be, because the inside linebackers have a ton of coverage and blitz responsibilities. You cannot be a dummy and play inside linebacker for the Steelers. And Shazier, now he's been in the league a few years, he's getting more comfortable. And when guys get comfortable, that's when they start playing fast. And Shazier played faster than any linebacker in the NFL by the end of last season.
Yeah.
You're a Steelers fan, Gary. Do you agree?
I'm not a Steelers fan, Andy. I'm a impartial journalist.
Yeah, you're an impartial editor, equal coverage for everybody, who has a couple of bobblehead dolls and towels hanging from his...
No.
Well,
I have
more, because you guys changed the office.
Exactly. I have a terrible towel neatly folded somewhere in the somewhere in my desk at the new office. But... yeah, the whole thing with Shazier when he was coming out of Ohio State was, you know, he played at like 220 at Ohio State, and it was kind of like, man, they're going to play a 220-pound inside linebacker on the Steelers? And, you know, I think it was more the mental part of the game that slowed him down as a rookie, but physically, he's never really had a problem. And, you know, that's the way the league has gone. You have smaller, faster players now, but Yeah. There's
But he's put on some weight as well, so he's taken some of the sting off of the, because 220 is awfully extreme. I think that is tough to ask a guy in that scheme, but he's listed at 237 now. You never know what guys really weigh, because they get listed at whatever the team wants them to be listed at.
Yep.
But it takes a while to learn it in that scheme in Pittsburgh, and we saw that with Lawrence Timmons. He didn't just step in and play right away either. He took a few years to get into the lineup, and then after that took a few years to really get comfortable and become the guy he is today. And I think Timmons belongs in our conversation here. He didn't make our rankings, though, did he?
He didn't. He was a others receiving vote. He got 6 points. The threshold was 14. I think you were, you gave him a 13th place vote. I had him 18th, which counts for nothing, Lawrence Timmons. I'm sorry.
Very good on blitzes. And the inside linebackers often work together on the blitz concepts in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And so you can't, it's not enough to have just one. You got to have them both understanding that part of the game. Timmons, at his best a few years ago, was the most explosive inside linebacking blitzer in the NFL. And I think Shazier can now become that guy.
Interesting. So just recapping very quickly, Andy did not vote for Jarrell Freeman. I had him 15th. Irwin had him 3rd, which I guess is starting to make Andy's blood boil here. DeAndre Levy, Andy had him 9th. No votes from myself or from Irwin. I had Levy 17th. He was my 2nd others receiving vote. Trevathan, let's see, you did not vote for Trevathan, is that correct? Yeah.
I did, but it wasn't like I was not voting for him. He just didn't make my list. But I have no problem with him being on anyone else's list.
I had him 11, Irwin had him 6, and Ryan Shazier, you had him 12, I had him 9. I guess I am a Steelers homer, and Irwin did not cast a vote for Ryan Shazier.
So Shazier's one of the guys that Irwin screwed with his other picks in.
Yeah, well,
I think we just want to keep track of these guys. Because with Irwin picking who he does, someone's getting screwed as well. It's a finite number of spots.
Yeah.
It's just worth putting a mention on that.
Well, there's the guy we have up at, there's a top 5 guy who didn't make his list, which, we can talk about it then. Tied for 11th here, we have Brandon Marshall and Anthony Barr. Now, we'll start with Barr. He was not on your list. He was on the back end of mine. I had him at 13. Irwin had him at 2. He's a guy who rates very highly in Pro Football Focus and some of the grading services. And he came into the league as a guy who, he was supposed to take 3 or 4 years before you could really use him as a full-time player. I'm just curious what you've seen from Barr, because I'm assuming you don't have a problem necessarily with him. You just don't necessarily think he's one of the top 15 linebackers in the league.
Well, I thought he was better as a rookie than as a sophomore last season. And so that's all that gave me pause. I heard another coach, and this is not necessarily my opinion, but I listened to NFL coaches, and these were guys that had to play against him, and they used the word soft with Anthony Barr, which really surprised me, because you look at his body type and the way he takes on blocks. I guess I would say I disagree with that description, but I share the story because the point is, opinions vary about Anthony Barr at this point. You have to have a high football IQ to play for Mike Zimmer. And Barr has played as a rookie, so I think he must be okay there. But I'm not sure it's exactly what you want there. You wonder about the cerebralness a little bit. Is he a better athlete than football player at this point? Not a lot of guys move as well as he does with his body type, though. And he's a good blitzer, and I think he can drop in coverage. And that's critical because they do those double A-gap blitzes where the Anthony Barr, along with Eric Kendricks, they're going to line up over the shoulder of the center, and that changes the offense's protections. And either those guys lining up over the shoulder, they can rush the QB, or more often than not, they have to retreat into coverage because they've impacted the protection. Now they want to go impact the coverage. And so we're talking about versatility, a wider range of skills. And Barr has the physical skill set to do it. The smarter you are, the easier it becomes. So I think in that sense, this is a big season for Barr coming up. This will be a telling season.
Yeah. And he was a guy, part of the reason he's raw, he played offense early in his career at UCLA. I actually remember him as being, I think they call him the F-back or something like that in the offense they were running. And sort of an H-back, tight end fullback type of guy. But Yeah, I think he's made a much faster impact than anyone expected him. But I'm surprised that anyone's calling him soft.
Yeah, I am too, because he takes on blocks. And usually when you are called soft, like people used to call Brian Urlacher soft
Yeah.
because he would privately in the NFL. I don't think announcers would go on TV and say that.
Yeah.
But he would slip blocks a lot of times and try to finesse around blocks or outmaneuver them rather than
Okay.
taking them on. You could argue it's smarter depending on the situation.
Yeah.
It's smarter to slip the block, and especially with if the runs are coming out of spread formations, which more of them are now. But the point is, I don't agree that Barr is a soft player, but there were guys who played against him that felt he could be attacked in that way.
Well, tied for Barr here at 11th is Brandon Marshall. I was surprised to see him not on your list because I thought you were pretty high on him. But look, I had Marshall 6th on my list. I thought 2 years ago when Trevathan was injured, I thought Marshall was tremendous, sort of holding down the linebacking core in Denver. And obviously they have so much stardom on the defensive line and in the secondary that I think he gets overlooked a little bit. Maybe I'm overrating him a little bit based on, I don't know, the overall success of that defense, but I think he's rock solid in the middle for the Broncos.
I don't disagree. This is a deep position, and I was surprised when I actually typed out all the linebackers to consider here, and I had about 35 names, and Brandon Marshall was certainly one of those names. I think he is a good player. I don't quite know what to do. He is surrounded by absolutely perfect circumstances.
Yeah.
He's got three cornerbacks around him who could play man to man. So therefore, the safeties become more flexible, which means the linebackers have more opportunities to play with aggression, less field to cover, whatever you want to do. He's got the edge rushers, obviously, with Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware and all the benefits that come from that and how disruptive that is to an offense. And then Denver has pretty good interior defense alignment in the run game, Sylvester Williams and Derek Wolfe. So there's not a linebacker in the league that has better conditions around him. Now, that probably you don't fault a guy for that. I think it makes them a little bit harder to evaluate. Like, we're going to go some of the names that are coming up a little bit later here. I happen to put Paul Posluszny on my list, or Telvin Smith for Jacksonville. Those guys have imperfect conditions around them. Similar type of run defense scheme, but less talent. And so I find it easier to evaluate those guys than the guys who are playing with superstars.
Fair enough. All right, Andy, we're going to take a quick 20-second break here, and we will be right back with the top 10 linebackers in football. NBA free agency has seen almost $2 billion spent already. On SI's NBA podcast, Open Floor, Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver give listeners the inside story on the richest NBA offseason we've ever had. Find Open Floor on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, or at si.com/podcasts. Now, Andy, before we jump back into the linebacker countdown, I actually want to take a moment to tell you how wonderful you are based on something you wrote 2 years ago after the 2015 draft. So, not quite 2 years ago, but a while ago.
Okay, yeah.
You had written, and you took a lot of flack for this. You had written the Chicago Bears had to replace every starter on their defense except for which Fuller do they have? They have Kendall. No, they have Kyle. They have Kyle Fuller.
Kyle Fuller, yeah.
So you had, and I'm bringing this up because we just talked about the two Bears inside linebackers, the two new guys. Do you know how many, including the nickelback? So we're talking 12 players. Do you know how many players the Bears have replaced among their starting defenders since you wrote that?
I think, are they up to all 10 now? Have they gotten all 10 of them done?
10 out of 12. And that doesn't include Leonard Floyd, who is presumably going to be more of a sub-package guy his rookie year.
Right.
So
Who's the one holdover? Is it Lamar Houston? Who's the one guy that's left? Is it
it's
Lamar
what
Houston?
McPhee was new. So yeah, I
Other
think it's
than
Lamar
Fuller.
Houston. I think it's Lamar Houston and Fuller are the two starters left.
And Houston, I thought, would have been replaced. He actually had like 8 sacks last year. He was
Yeah.
not as good as his numbers indicated. But I think they're wanting to replace Houston because we see them take Fuller. They signed McPhee last year. They still
Yeah.
have Willie Young. So
Yeah.
I knew I said they needed 10 new guys because A, they did, and B, I knew that Vic Fangio felt that way, their D coordinator. Yeah. And if he felt that way, chances are the front office agreed with him.
Well, they did it. Emily Kaplan actually wrote that story. We're talking about, you know, she's out in Chicago now, and we're talking about what story she'd do on the Bears. And it's like, you know, Andy wrote 2 years ago they were going to replace 10 starters on defense, and over 18 months they brought in 10 new defensive starters, not to mention the guy they just took top 10 in the draft. So pretty good, Andy. Pretty good.
Yeah. I know the feeling in Chicago right now, because they had a nice season on defense last year. They certainly overachieved. Because they've continued to replace guys, so they didn't feel comfortable with their players quite yet. And the feeling there is that all they've accomplished so far under John Fox is they've torn down what the previous regime built, and now they're starting new construction.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's jump back into the countdown here. We are at the top 10, and our first guy who's not in a tie for his position here, so we can devote a little more time to him, Telvin Smith, Jacksonville Jaguars, at the 10 spot, finishing well ahead of his teammate, Paul Bozosny. I had him, he was the first guy off my list. He was 16th. You had him, you're obviously high on him. You had him 7. I always thought Telvin Smith was sort of like a less physical Ryan Shazier as far as his skill set goes. Fastest linebacker in football, probably? Is anyone faster than this guy right now?
I don't know. Because he covers a lot of ground when he moves, which... Is so he moves fast, but he's a long, lanky body that moves fast. And the more he's played, the better he's gotten at taking angles to the ball and identifying stuff. And that would make sense because he's in a system under Gus Bradley that emphasizes speed to the ball. And it's been the same system. It's fairly, it's not rudimentary, but it's very straightforward. You know what you're doing. You know your job when you're playing in that system. So he fits the system really well for them. I like him. He flashes on film every week. Robert Klemko interviewed him when Klemko and I were at Eagles camp together. It was over the phone, and he got to talking to him. So I think the secret's out, because Klemko wrote about him. I think the secret's out a little bit on Telvin Smith now.
Yeah.
He needs to get paid at some point. What's his – do you know his – I'm going to look it up right now.
I think he's going into year 3 right now, right?
Yeah, he's not an old guy. Yeah, he signed a 4-year deal. It's a rookie deal, so he's still on his rookie deal. He's making, he's making less than a he's making well under $1 million a season right now.
Yeah,
he needs to hold out. I'll tell you what, he's got 2 years left. If he doesn't get paid after this season, he needs to hold out.
Yeah.
Well, he's making $650,000. $745,000 next year, $742,000 to be precise.
Well, what's the rule? You can't even renegotiate until 1 year left.
Is that what it is?
On your rookie deal,
Jacksonville would be wise to sign him sooner than later as well, because he's gotten so much better with every snap of the ball. He's getting better with experience. He's only going to get more expensive.
Yeah. Well, he was certainly fine. They got him in the 5th round, pick 144, back in the 2014 draft. And, you know, I think it was the fact that he's, you know, he's sort of a safety build. He's a lanky guy. 6'3", 220 is 223 is what they list him at. So not a traditional linebacker build, but certainly for the way the game is being played right now, a guy who has a ton of value.
And he's gotten better in coverage. We've seen his impact more in coverage now, which is always the next step for a linebacker.
Yep. Coming in tied for 8th here, we have Lavonte David and we have KJ Wright, Seattle, 22 points apiece here. I guess let's start with David, who I feel would have been easily top 5 if we were doing this list a year ago. Did he have a down year last year, or I don't know. I don't know if he just got lost concerning the Bucs were doing some better things offensively, and you know, I don't know why he sort of didn't pop up when I watched the Bucs last year.
Well, he did not show up at all on film in September and October, and even a little bit in November.
Yeah.
And so I think that alone makes it a down year, because, yes, Lavonte David's a top 5 linebacker. Now, I wrote that, and I sent that to one of my fact checkers, Cal Kleiman's his name, and he wrote back to me. I'm gonna read it. Mm-hmm. He said David may not have stood out until November, But from November onwards, he was a monster. David's numbers from November 15th onwards prorated over a full season. So if he'd averaged this over the season, he would have had about 100 tackles, 2 forced fumbles, 6 interceptions, 4 sacks, and 16 passes defensed. No player in NFL history has ever recorded those numbers over a full season.
Yeah.
So, and over the past 20 years, only 9 players have had 80-plus tackles with 2 forced fumbles, 3 interceptions, and 3 sacks. David's done that twice now. So he's a versatile guy. Tampa Bay's run defense was undermanned last season. They were without Gerald McCoy at his best. Mm-hmm. Quan Alexander got suspended in the second half of the year. And yet this run defense ranked second to Denver in yards per carry. So Lavonte David did not show up on film. But he must have. I think this is a good argument for him here is he was better than his – this is rare, Gary, but he was maybe better than how he looked on film.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, he just – I don't know what it was. I just did not notice him during Bucs games for the bulk of last season.
I'm going to pitch to you a Lavonte David story in a few weeks, by the way, because his people emailed me wanting to do something about Big Brothers, Big Sisters. He does that charity along with Chris Harris.
All right.
And I think it's a really cool thing that he does with those guys. We all know the charity stories don't read well. There's not very much entertainment, but in some cases, like I know Chris Harris has an actual little brother, not a biological one. He mentors somebody in the charity. Can you imagine signing up for Big Brothers, Big Sisters? You're a young kid, you need a mentor, and they give you an NFL Pro Bowler.
Yeah. Couldn't get Peyton Manning. Can get a quarterback. He's not on my fantasy team, so I don't know. No, that's pretty good. Lavonte David tied with KJ Wright, who I didn't rank, actually, but Irwin was high on him. Irwin had him 4, and you had him 11. I had him down there. He was like 20 or something on my list.
And KJ Wright does a lot of things for them, yeah.
He
does a lot in Seattle.
It's funny. I still think back to KJ Wright, and all I think of is trying to match up with Gronk in the Super Bowl, which he actually did fairly well, but then they had him. Klemko, actually, I'm editing Klemko's piece right now where he talks about why ISO formations, and that was sort of the most famous example.
Yeah, Klemko and I talked a lot about that last week.
Yeah, they got Gronk out isolated on KJ Wright, and Seahawks thought that would work. They had no safety help, and obviously that was a disastrous result in Super Bowl 49. But I guess they asked him to do a lot of coverage stuff, so he can do it. They have the confidence in him to do it. What do you think of KJ Wright?
Well, keep in mind, if Gronk burned him on an island, that means the Seahawks were comfortable enough with KJ Wright and what they know of him
exactly.
to ask him to be on the island in the first place.
Yeah.
Now, on the play that Klemko's talking about, I think, if I recall, New England noticed that Seattle was playing 2 high safeties out of their hurry-up, their 2-minute defense. And if you're playing 2 high safeties, then that means a linebacker has to cover the tight end because the safeties are both back deep. And so my guess is Tom Brady saw that, called the play for Gronkowski on the island, and that's why Tom Brady's probably the greatest quarterback of all time. I would not fault KJ Wright for that. It wasn't a good play, but there are a lot of guys he has covered man-to-man extremely well. And we talked about those Bears linebackers, how they might compare to the 49er linebackers in terms of coverage from years ago.
Mm-hmm.
KJ Wright's a guy that covers running backs and tight ends. He's got long arms. He understands. He has good spatial reasoning. He is very disciplined in run defense as well. I like KJ Wright. I know John Gruden, and Gruden exaggerates. We know that. But he said in a Monday night broadcast last year that you could argue KJ Wright's the best linebacker in the league or one of the best in certain very significant categories. I think he said the best all-around linebacker in the league.
Okay. Well, perhaps I stand corrected on that for not putting him on my list. So David and Wright tied at 8. In 7th, we had Navarro Bowman, who I had Bowman 3. I thought he was really good last year on a team that was just disintegrating around him. I mean, they obviously don't have the talent level that they used to have there. I thought he was really good, especially coming off the knee problems he had had. I think he could still cover, and obviously he's, a guy you can trust in the run game. What did you see from Bowman last year compared to Bowman pre-injury?
He wasn't quite as fluid, and change of direction was a little bit of an issue, and that's going to show up when you're in pass defense. or when the ball reaches you at a high speed in space, like if a running back breaks through the hole quickly and now you've got to make a play on an island. So he got better as the season went on, though, and he probably it appeared he got healthier. I'm real encouraged to see what he looks like this year.
Yeah,
he made the All-Pro team last season. He didn't deserve that, though. The guys we're about to list now, and some of the guys we've already talked about, had better seasons than him. But what happened was the media was aware of Bowman because he was coming back from the injury. And so they weren't giving him courtesy votes, I'm sure. Maybe some were. Or charity votes is probably a better term. They weren't doing that. But when you're more aware of a guy, then you start to appreciate and notice more of the things he's good at. But Bowman was a much better player before the injury. So I think he would tell you this is the big year for him. And last season was a feeling out process.
Okay. Yeah, you know, it's the old rule of thumb that you got to play a full season on that reconstructed knee before you can really have the confidence in it to sort of get back to where you were. So Bowman comes in 7.
Yeah, and not keep in mind, not all knee injuries are the same either. And I think I'm not a doctor. I think, was more severe and more complicated than other guys'.
Yeah. Bowman coming
in 7. And speaking of knee injuries,
Look at
who's our next guy.
Andy, don't step on my transition. I spent all night writing this one.
Sorry.
Speaking of knee injuries, Thomas Davis comes in 6th. Davis, the old, you know, he's the sort of, I feel like he's kind of like the godfather of all these, you know, Levante David and Telvin Smith and these sort of defensive back builds but linebacker players. Thomas Davis was kind of like the original coming out of Georgia. He was you know, do you play him at safety or do you play him on the weak side? And you know, with all the injury problems he has, the fact that he still gets around the way he does and the amount of range he has in coverage is just amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah, it is. It's truly amazing. We've talked about Josh Norman for Carolina and how they let him go, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And without Thomas Davis on the roster, they may not have done that because what Davis gives them is such range and such speed that they can play their zone coverages differently. They can play their linebackers deeper in zone coverage. And that means the cornerbacks and safeties have less burden placed upon them. And so Thomas Davis and the zone coverage, and not just zone, it's more zone, but he can match up within the zone as well and take a guy. But his blitzing is incredible. As a setup guy, taking out blockers to set up guys stunting around him, or just as an attacker himself, his transitional speed is what's so great. And that's what's hard to reconcile with his knee injuries, because you would think after 3 of those things, maybe he can still run fast, but most of the time a guy's not going to transition into running fast very well, which is the difference.
Yeah.
Thomas Davis transitions just fine. I think he's an incredible player. It's neat because you think, well, he's getting a ton off of old KG veteran stuff, and he is that, but it's not that. He's still he's a better athlete than most of the guys he's facing, still in his 30s with a 3-time repaired knee or 3 big knee injuries to his name.
Yep.
Who have we seen guys in other sports or even the NFL? I can't think of NFL guys who have had the absolute prime of their career, like just bottomed out, like they didn't get to have those years, and yet they still had a tremendous career. Who would be the closest to that? Like Michael Vick lost his prime, but he wasn't Michael Vick when he came back. He had that 1 year in Philadelphia in 2010. But he wasn't Michael Vick in any of the other years.
This isn't, and again, sorry to leave the football world for this, and this isn't even that good a comparison because he wasn't a star when he came back, but I always think of Antonio McDice because everyone thought he was done in the NBA after he had microfracture surgery, which at the time was a death sentence to have microfracture surgery, especially for a guy who relied on his athleticism like that. But he came back and was productive.
Yeah.
He was never a superstar, but he was productive for the rest of his NBA career. But yeah, a guy who lost his prime years.
Davis is McDice with the dunking ability, the explosive elevation still in his game coming back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you could put some pictures with Tommy John, but that doesn't really count anymore. But
maybe we could ask our listeners, instead of sending us questions or complaints, which they'll probably do anyway, and they're welcome to, but if they can come up with some names, I'd be real interested to know.
Yeah. Yeah, send us Looking for guys who lost their prime and came back as superstars. Thomas Davis, certainly one of them. He is sixth in our countdown. Andy, we're going to take a 24-second break here and then come back with the top five linebackers in the NFL. The boys of summer are halfway home in SI's baseball podcast. The Strike Zone is taking listeners all the way to the World Series. It's always a good time when Ted Keith and Steve Canella chop it up on The Strike Zone. Find it on iTunes, Stitcher, your favorite podcast app, or si.com/podcasts.
Hey, Gary.
Yeah.
You just mentioned the baseball. How do you feel about unwritten rules in baseball?
They're lame.
I have a theory about it.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
This is summertime. We've got nothing to do, so we're gonna invade another podcast here and see how they react.
There you go.
I think baseball. The reason baseball has unwritten rules and they're so strictly followed is because not enough goes on in the sport. Like you're a baseball guy. I think you're standing around. You're waiting for the pitches. The ball comes to you maybe five times in a game. You've got a lot of time to think out there. And I think guys, and you're sitting in the dugout, you're not batting most of the time. So it's conducive to just sitting and stewing and thinking. And eventually you're just going to find ways to get slighted and offended because you're a big time alpha male athlete with pride, damn it. And how dare that guy run too fast after a home run or not fast enough? How dare he look at the ball he just hit over us? You got time to think. In football, that would never happen because the next play is going on and there's so much happening on one play. You can't sit around and come up with petty arguments. It's just like how a neighbor who you know as a kid, the old shut-in guy, he's the one who's cranky about his yard growing up when you're growing up. It's not the guy who's working from 9 to 6 and having to deal with three kids when he gets home. You could run across his yard and he doesn't throw a fit.
That's actually not a bad theory.
Baseball sucks. No, I'm kidding. Peter won't let us say that. But I think that's what happens. I think they don't have enough to do out there.
It also, it's just a sport that it hasn't evolved a lot. The way it's played hasn't evolved a lot. I mean, you watch old football games and old basketball games. It's a different sport than what's played now. And it's just sort of, it's still sort of ruled by, cranky older people who don't like the way the kids do. I mean, if Babe Ruth flipped his bat when he was playing, maybe he did. I don't even know. I haven't seen footage of him ever flipping a bat. But I think it would be perfectly acceptable. It's just, and there are some unwritten, you remember the old Shiano thing where they were playing the Giants and Eli was kneeling down at the end of the game to seal the win. They were in victory formation and the Bucks guys rushed the center to try and force the fumble. And it was kind of like, you're technically that, improves your chances from 1 in a billion to 1 in 900 million to win the game. So yes, that's a play that, you're trying to win, but it doesn't, you can't do it. You're just putting people at risk, but that also is, you're putting people at injury risk when you do that. Whereas with baseball, weird.
I think there's a technicality to stand on there though, which is like you said, it improves the chances. So technically there is. Baseball, there's no technicality to stand on.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I've been in, I've covered the four major sports. Well, soccer is also a major sport.
Three major sports.
Not in the U.S. when I was coming up. But I've been in all the locker rooms and the clubhouses, and baseball players are by far just, they're miserable. I mean, it's such a, you get some exceptions. Evan Longoria is one of my favorite people to talk to, and Justin Verlander was always phenomenal. But, I mean, God, they're just miserable people to deal with, and it's so uncomfortable trying to have any sort of conversation with a baseball player. They're just.
Do you have a quick story that paints an illustration of why you say that?
Nomar Garciaparra once. I actually reached out to the Dodgers and said we're doing a piece on Nomar. It's a little bit like the stuff that has been written about him all year. He had transitioned to first base that year, so I just want to make sure that. If I come out to Shea Stadium at the time and talk to Nomar, will he be willing to discuss this stuff? Because I'm not going to go out there if he's just going to shut it down and give me a bunch of cliched answers. And they said, oh, yeah, Nomar said he'll totally do it. And I got out there, and I mean, what a complete crank. He totally shut it down, and he was like, well, how about you don't ask me questions when I'm trying to get ready for a game or something like that? And I was like, all right, I'm just going to go up to the press box. And I was once in an argument with Victor Martinez. I tried to get a quick quote from him post-game, and he said he doesn't talk post-game, and we argued about it for like 3 minutes. And in the end, I said, if you had just given me the quote, we would have been done in 20 seconds. Instead, we've been arguing about this for 3 minutes about how you won't talk to me. And it's just stuff like that. They view themselves as very blue collar. And look, it is. It's a day-to-day grind. I accept that and respect that.
No, it's not. Come on.
They are there for a long time. You show up early to the ballpark and you're there for a long time. I get it's taking up a large part of your life. It's 6 or 7 games a week. But yeah, those guys.
That's everybody's job. Everybody goes to work for 8 hours a day.
I work more of like a 20-hour week. But no, if I'm never in another baseball clubhouse, I will not miss it ever.
Yeah.
Anyways, let's jump back into the
number five
countdown with that. Coming in fifth here, Bobby Wagner, our second and highest ranked Seahawk. One of us did not rank him. You had him at, I had him at 2, and you had him at 4. Wagner is similarly to what we talked about with Brandon Marshall. Wagner certainly benefits from the talent around him. I think he's still very good in coverage. I think even if you took away Earl Thomas, I think Wagner's a guy who would hold his own in the middle of the field covering tight ends. But and obviously he's, good range, good run defender.
Yeah, he blitzes well too. Seattle doesn't blitz often, but when they do, Wagner is almost always part of that equation. I think he's very good at it. I forget, someone at Sports Illustrated a few years ago, and I forget to the degree that I'm not even going to remember the name if I try, so I apologize. But he was working on a story about how tackle stats are the most overrated stats in football, which they are. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yep.
And the reason they're overrated is because every play, for the most part, ends in a tackle.
Yes.
So it's not like it's a matter of who gets the tackle. There's a number of tackles to go around, and who do they go to, and where are they coming on the field? And he wanted to know who's one guy that's an example of making tackles that are productive tackles, that are within the confines of the play, within the structure of the scheme, and are actually stopping the ball on schedule and helping the defense. And the name I said Bobby Wagner is probably the best, purest illustration of that. And he said, that's what every coach has said so far, is Bobby Wagner.
Yeah? Nice. See, that's
you
a,
don't
that's
believe
a good
that? Guy. Like, you have a question mark on that.
No, I think that's a great note. Michael McKnight, was it the Michael McKnight piece?
Yes, it was. Thank you, Michael
you
McKnight. And, boy, you are good at remembering all the stories that come through, by the way. You remember that stuff extremely well.
Well, that's what I do here for my 3 hours a day. I read stuff.
The question, though, you mentioned Brandon Marshall, and we do have to address, I don't know how we address it. And I don't know how I justify that it gave me pause on Brandon Marshall, but not on Bobby Wagner. I think Wagner's a little better player, but not drastically. Is that Wagner's surrounded by so many good players as well. He's probably got the second best conditions next to Brandon Marshall for all linebackers.
I'll say this. 2 years ago, I think it was the 2014 season, someone had given Wagner, it was either an MVP vote or a Defensive Player of the Year vote in a year where he missed.
Yep.
Let me bring up specifically how many games he missed. Yeah.
He missed 5 games. And I know who it was that gave it to him. Do you know who? Do you want me to say who it was?
I don't
That's
remember
the fun
who
of
it was.
It was Tony Dungy.
No. Was it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone had written basically the justification for giving Wagner that vote, and it wasn't Dungy because Dungy, I don't think Dungy's running a blog anywhere, but the justification was basically the Seahawks defensively were clearly worse that year statistically in the games that Wagner missed, so ergo Bobby Wagner is very, it's construing the term valuable in a much different way than
Well, in that case, Tom Brady was the MVP of 2008 because the Patriots missed the playoffs and he missed all 16 games or 15 and a half. It was Dungy. He was the one guy. It came in the 2014 season. Positive, 100%.
But there you go. Like, putting that aside, though, that's a legitimate argument. I mean, on the Broncos, if you took away Brandon Marshall, you'd still presumably have a great defense. And the Seahawks were still a very good defense, but they weren't at the same level. They weren't really near the same level when Wagner missed all that time.
Right, but you can't give Wagner credit for missing time, which is what you're doing if he's getting an MVP vote because of how bad everyone was around him when he misses time.
Oh, I'm not even talking MVP vote anymore. I'm helping you out by letting you bridge that logic gap between discounting Marshall for the supporting cast but not discounting Wagner for the supporting cast. I'm trying to help you out.
I gotcha. Yeah.
And well, you just want to go after nice Tony Dungy.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, Bobby Wagner coming in fifth. Coming in fourth is Derek Johnson. And I want to ask you something very specifically about Derek Johnson, who obviously has had a very good career for a long time at this point. What was he, a 2005, 2006 draft pick? He's been...
Yep, 2005.
You know, he's been a stalwart in KC forever here. But I was never really sold on Johnson's coverage abilities, and I feel like, and I said the same thing about Eric Berry when we did safeties, I feel like the fact that they didn't play a very good schedule, and again, I hate emphasizing the schedule, but I think that sort of covered up any deficiencies he might have in that area. So I guess my question is, do you consider Johnson well-rounded?
Yes, within the context of what they do, because what Johnson gives them is the ability. He's not the cover guy, but he is so good against the run, especially in space. There's that theme again, guys in space. He is so good at shooting gaps, identifying play designs, and chasing down ball carriers. He moves like a deer out there, that they can play extra safeties. They don't have to put other linebackers on the field. Yeah. So Johnson might not be the cover guy, but they can put more cover guys around him because he compensates so well in run defense. And for a few years there, and I don't know if they'll do it now because they're not as deep in the secondary as they have been in past seasons. But for a few years there, Kansas City was playing a safety, a three safety, or even a four safety dime package a lot of the time. And Hussein Abdullah was the guy with Johnson. So I thought Johnson was extremely valuable with him. He's interesting, too, because his career did not get off the ground very well. He was average to – I think a lot of people felt he was soft for the first three, maybe even 4 years of his career. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until about 2010 or 2011 where he looked like the guy that you take in the first round. And he's, to his credit, he's looked like that every year since. Even after he had an Achilles injury, he came back. He's 33 years old now. He'll be 34 in November, mid-30s post-Achilles injury. He's still every bit as good as he was in 2011, 2012. And you know the other thing? Derek Johnson passes the name test as well. I always think, like, remember Channing Crowder for the Dolphins?
Yeah.
What I was watching Dolphins film one offseason, and it struck me all at once. It's, you know what? Channing Crowder's really not that good. I think people know him because his name is so unique and crisp and cool sounding, Channing Crowder. So what if a guy's name just Joe Smith or John Doe or whatever, or Derek Johnson? That's pretty plain. Then what would we think of him? And Derek Johnson's number four with one of the – probably the plainest name of all the – certainly the plainest name of all the linebackers we've seen.
There you go.
In this discussion.
Well, he had – you and I both had him fifth and Irwin had him tenth, so – yeah, he got respect across the board from the analytics community and the not as analytics community.
Oh, so now Irwin's the analytics community.
He sort of is. No, he is.
He represents it.
Because he had a bar that
high.
I think it was based on analytics. So we are actually into the top three here. We had a tie for second, and that was Sean Lee and Jamie Collins. Now, I'll let you start off on Sean Lee here. You had him 2, I had him 7, Irwin had him 12. And look, he was a tough guy to place just because he's missed so much time the last couple of years. He'll presumably, with Rolando McClain out forever with the suspension, you know, he'll basically man middle linebacker again, full time.
I would think that's where you would play him because the other guys they have around him are better outside than inside, I would think.
Now, do you like him better in the middle or on the weak side?
That's a good question, and it depends a little bit on your scheme. In a cover two scheme, which Dallas is purport to be that, I think they're much more than that, but for the linebacking sake, let's call them the cover two scheme. Having Sean Lee on the edge is vital because that becomes the primary run defender in a lot of your run gap responsibilities, and we don't have to get into why, but the ball is designed to spill. They teach those guys up front to spill the ball outside, force a running back to bounce outside, and that's why you need a weak side linebacker who could run so well, and that's the old Derek Brooks thing from Tampa Bay. Sean yep. Lee's that guy. As a read and react linebacker, I think that's where he's at his best. And the closer you are to the middle of the field, then the crisper and faster you must be as a reader and reactor. And putting Sean Lee at middle linebacker averts a lot of problems and creates a lot of advantages for you. So I'm fine with wherever he lines up. If I had to pick, I'd say just take schemes out of it, go player type. I'd probably put him at middle linebacker.
Okay. Do you know the last time Sean Lee played 16 games in a season?
I do not. Has he ever done it?
Never. Never, Andy.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of kind of a misleading question.
So he is tied for second.
Sean Lee is like, and he's the football player, and then Jamie Collins is the athlete. And yeah. they both cross over well. Neither one of them is stuck in only that box.
Yeah.
Jamie Collins terrifies people who have to play against him. He terrifies them. And the versatility is what's so scary. I think he's the most athletic as it pertains to his position. Other than J.J. Watt, I think Jamie Collins is the most athletic player in the NFL on defense.
Now, this might be anecdotal evidence that I'm going off of here, and maybe it's just me, but I feel like whenever something goes wrong with the Patriots defense, when they give up a big play or something like that, Jamie Collins is in the middle of it. And that might just be because they're asking him to do things that no other linebacker would be asked to do. But, I mean, is he uneven to you? Is he inconsistent to you?
No, I know why you're saying that. I think there's two reasons for that. Mm-hmm. One is they do so many different things with their fronts that the run defense is so dependent on being synchronized and everyone on the same page. And most of their run defense schemes, it's up to Hightower and Collins to make the tackle or get to the ball. Yeah. That doesn't mean they're the only ones making the play, but by nature, they're going to be in the picture. So if the run defense goes poorly, chances are Hightower or Collins will look like they're involved. And that doesn't mean they're the guys that messed it up, though. The other thing is when Collins goes out on an island as a cornerback, kind of like what we talked about with Wagner covering Gronkowski at tight end, mm-hmm. which I bet Collins does in practice, so he gets good practice.
Yeah.
I think he's not great at that. I think he has the tools to be, but he gives up more plays than his tool set says he should as an isolation man-to-man defender. So about once a game, you're going to see a pass thrown against him downfield, and more often than is necessary, those passes are getting completed or there's a PI or something like that. Yeah. He needs to polish up just a little bit there. But I don't think he's nearly as raw as what meets the eye. I think he's a much better football player than people realize, but he's so much of a better athlete than football player that he's never going to get noticed for that.
Yeah.
Quick Jamie Collins story. He's also learned the Patriot way because – and what we mean by the Patriot way is kind of like how you griped about Nomar Garciaparra. He doesn't help the media out a whole lot. And neither would I, by the way, if I played in the NFL.
Yeah.
But I asked him before the Super Bowl, and it was at Media Day, so it doesn't mean anything at all because that we know how Media Day goes, and all those Super Bowl media things are like that anymore. But I was convinced that he was going to spy Russell Wilson in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
They didn't wind up doing that. But I asked him, how good of a spy do you think or how well do you think you could spy Russell Wilson or how important it is? Some kind of open-ended question to see if he'd say he's spying him. And his answer was, Russell Wilson's a very good player, and when you spy him, you have to do a good job. And I asked him the question again, and he said the same type of thing. I was just kind of impressed with that. It was frustrating. We had to redo the whole video because we got nothing. But Jamie Collins has been coached on and off the field extremely well there in New England.
Yeah, yeah.
When you fire Russell Wilson, you have to do a good job.
There you go. That's a great answer. It's true.
It's not wrong. Yeah, it's not wrong.
Exactly. That is a truth he spoke to you, Andy. You ready to move on to number one?
Yeah. Does it feel like we've had a lot of number ones where it's a consensus? It's an obvious number one?
The last couple have been. I mean, we did Gronkowski. There were some that were, you know, a little bit. We had Watt last or two shows ago. Last show with the offensive line, I mean, it could have gone a couple different ways. Cornerbacks was a potential debate there.
Yeah.
But there was no debate with the linebackers. Luke Kuechly was the consensus number one, unanimous number one, I should say. I mean, look, he's unbelievable in coverage, and one play that still sticks out in my mind was in the, what was it, the divisional round when they beat the Seahawks last year, and the Seahawks were making that frantic attempt at a comeback, and they were closing the gap, and there was a play where Russell Wilson scrambled a little bit through to the left sideline. Guy comes in, breaks it up, and I was like, who is the white defensive back on the Panthers? And it was like, oh my God, it's Kuechly. I can't believe how far downfield and how far down the sideline he was to break up that play. You know, that happens like once a game when I watch the Panthers. I'm like, that doesn't register. That can't be a linebacker. Oh my God, it's Kuechly.
Yeah. Well, the play that stands out to me that best illustrates Kuechly. First of all, he's the best run defender in the NFL. No one reads their keys faster and better than Luke Kuechly.
Yep.
But the play on the topic that you're talking about, which I think has set him apart because he has improved in coverage so much, is the interception against Dallas on Thanksgiving, where he ran down the middle of the field with a receiver and made the pick. That's a critical play because in that scheme, that's Tampa 2 coverage, and Carolina uses that concept a lot. And in Tampa 2, the middle linebacker has the deepest inside receiving threat, which means if it's a three-receiver set and they put a wide receiver as the guy closest inside, like in that tight slot, then the linebacker's got to guard him. And Kuechly has done that successfully against tight ends and wide receivers. And that's incredibly rare, of course, and that's you get the matchup you want as an offense, and you wind up giving up a pick six. That's extremely demoralizing to play against, too.
Yep.
I guess, like, Ray Lewis was considered the best in the league around his third year in the NFL, too, wasn't he, if I recall?
Yeah. Yeah, that's about right.
That's about when Patrick Willis, it was similar. That's about when middle linebackers come into their own, which kind of tells you they either have it or they don't, because you probably haven't learned you haven't learned as much football by year three that you're going to know in year six. So yeah. There's a physical element to playing linebacker. It's not all reads and keys and diagnosing and understanding coverage nuance. Sometimes you have to be a better athlete. And Kuechly, we forget, and probably because, frankly, he's the white guy. He's not dynamic looking, but he's a better athlete than everybody else, too.
Yeah. Yeah, we were out at his high school for the Super Bowl road trip last year. And, you know, it's easy to say it now. His coach put on some of his film from his junior, senior year at St. Xavier out in Cincinnati, or I guess technically Cincinnati. I don't know if it's city proper. But, you know, he was just – they play pretty good football out there, and just every play he's just shooting gaps, and, you know, he's just playing at a completely different speed. And you just kind of think, like, wow, how did this guy not – get offers from any of the big schools? He ended up, I mean, look, Boston College, good school, good program, but, you know, Ohio State wasn't interested. None of the big ones were interested in him.
Yeah. Luke Kuechly, he's only in his mid-20s.
Luke Kuechly, for those of us who are editing print stuff.
That's who he was to me coming in, because I don't watch college. It took me the longest time.
Yep. Well, that's our show. Luke Kuechly, number one in the linebacker countdown. Two shows left as far as the position rankings go. We'll have edge rushers next time, and then two shows from now will be the quarterbacks. Thanks, as always, to Jeff Irwin, our researcher, Alex Abnos, our producer and editor, and most of all, thank you to all of you who listen. Please send a note, mailbag question, whatever you want to send us, Andy and I, Twitter, Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI, we're both on Facebook, or talkback@themmqb.com. This was the MMQB Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We will see you next time.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.